All right, listen, bastards. You keep away from this bank or we're going to start throwing bodies out the front door one at a time. You got that?
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's bonus review of Dog Day Afternoon.
Did you have a plan or what? What did you do, just barge in on a whim?
A patron-exclusive review chosen by Sean Ray.
Oh, my man, I'm going to remember you.
Hosted by Stuart.
You don't understand. He's crazy.
Arnie.
Well, I'm out of the hospital.
And Jacob.
He's got a wife, children. He's a wonderful father.
But be warned, this episode will contain detailed plot spoilers and strong language.
Well, I'm a Christian, and my ears are not garbage cans.
We hope you enjoy the show.
Why don't you talk to me? Just talk to me straight. I'm ready to talk.
Okay.
Today we're discussing Dog Day Afternoon, starring Al Pacino, John Cazale, James Broderick, Charles Durning, directed by Sidney Lumet. I'm a fuck-up, and I'm an outcast, and I'm a co-host of Now Playing. This is Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is Jacob, and I would just like the press to know I am not a homosexual.
Not that there's anything wrong
with
that.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. Oh, we did that at the same time.
So welcome, patrons, to another one-off review here for just you guys. A review of a classic Dog Day Afternoon picked by one of you patrons, Sean Ray.
Yep, Sean has donated a lot. Very different movies. We just covered Bring Me the Head of Alfredo Garcia, made around the same time. A classic, gritty 70s movie. Was there a specific reason why he chose this, or does he just keeping in theme?
Well, he enjoyed our Al Pacino reviews we did back several years ago now when we were looking at Pacino as a cop and Pacino as a gangster. And this is Pacino as a criminal, and it's Sean Ray's favorite Pacino performance, saying he's so manic and looks like he's going to faint at any second due to the heat and stress. And he immediately empathizes with Pacino, never believing he's capable of hurting anyone. And he calls the twist of why he's robbing this bank one of the most bizarre he's ever seen. And so he wanted us to discuss the film, discuss the true story behind the film, and the director, Sidney Lumet.
It's funny he brings up the Pacino reviews that we did, because I think that's why I originally watched this. When I looked it up on Letterboxd, it was in 2018. I think that's when we did that Pacino stuff. And I, again, just wanted to see more of his films. And this was one I knew about. I thought it was a bank heist film. I was shocked to see where this film goes, the tones that it will go through throughout. I was very surprised by what this film ended up being.
Yeah, I always think that's a fun part of that. Like, this is one you don't want to know too much about. You don't want to be spoiler filled. You are supposed to just think that, yeah, it's a 70s movie about robbing a bank. And yeah, you'll find it takes you on a different journey. I actually had the pleasure of seeing this movie for the first time back in the movie theaters. Warner Brothers, for their 70th anniversary back in 1998, actually hosted a retrospective, and I paid a ticket for 70s Day. And that included Richard Donner's Superman, Blazing Saddles, Clockwork Orange, and The Exorcist. This was the one film on the bill that I didn't know, and it ended up being my favorite of the day because I was just so surprised, so blown away by what I thought it was going to be and where it actually took me.
And I'm the newbie on this review. I've not seen this film, but it has been on my to-watch list. A couple years back, I read Sidney Lumet's book, Making Movies. I highly recommend that book. And it really gave me an insight into his filmmaking techniques and made me want to see more of his films. I really love his 12 Angry Men. And Network is one of my favorite movies, a really good film there. We reviewed Serpico, so I wanted to see this. I actually put it on one afternoon and realized I was getting into it and didn't have time to finish the movie, and so I decided to save it, and then Sean Ray donated for this, and so I'm like, all right, I'm going to wait, and I'll be watching it for the first time when we review it on the show.
So you didn't hit the halfway point. You didn't know the twist.
I didn't know the twist. I just knew it was Al Pacino in the film. Honestly, I probably made it 15 minutes into the film and realized that I needed more time for it.
Which, if you've just seen that first 15 minutes, you're going to think you're watching a comedy for the next 2 hours.
And maybe maybe you are. I mean, I definitely think that that's part of the surprise, right? Is that the film goes in directions and, yeah, makes you laugh about things that are dark and, yeah, social commentary. I think that's one of the hallmarks. When you talk about Sidney Lumet, if you think about his career, I think he is one of the most Oscar-decorated of anybody. I think over 50 statues have been nominated throughout his career. He's made some acclaimed films. Yeah, his very first film, 12 Angry Men, they're always about social justice issues. I mean, whether it be the legal system or the Holocaust, he made one of the first movies about that with The Pawnbroker, Nuclear Annihilation. We always remember Dr. Strangelove, but Failsafe came first. That was him. The Wiz was about civil rights, believe it or not. And this movie, obviously, it is one of the first Hollywood movies to talk about queer visibility. But you wouldn't guess that from any of the marketing or promos or anything about the movie. I think that that would have been disguised. New Yorkers would have known about this because it is based on a true story. And what's kind of remarkable, Lumet says this in the commentary, I don't know if it's true, but I'll take him at his word, that this was the first mass hostage situation in American history, that we had never seen this many people taken prisoner for 12 hours on home soil. This was a story we would expect to see abroad. It seemed to me like there must be exceptions. It must have happened before, but it didn't make the news in the way that it did in 1972. And so, yes, this was a remarkable event in New York history. Years before Patty Hearst did similar things, years before we got used to, my impression of New York in the 70s is something like this happened on every corner,
yes,
every week. But that just shows you what media can warp your mind into thinking. This was considered a real novelty, even before you take on the reasons why Sonny is robbing the bank.
So this was a big New York story. Was it a big nationwide one? Because there's, at least based on this film, there's all this news and press and camera crews there. I don't know. I didn't go onto YouTube to see if any of this footage still exists and got uploaded, but it seems like it was a pretty big event, like a hostage situation. Yeah, that feels like it would go national.
It doesn't seem to have survived and made it into any of the bonus features or anything like that. They, of course, had access to it at the time. It was a Life magazine article. This thing drew more national attention, not so much in its hours of happening in the dog days of summer 1972, but in the months after, when a noted reporter published a story about it. And, you know, Life magazine was known for good pictures. The story was considered novel enough that, yeah, Sidney Lumet heard about it, read about it, and said, this could be something really interesting to do. Another thing I think about Lumet, if you think about his style, is he's a New York director. So anything that is about that city, I mean, he was raised there. He's not Hollywood. All of his acclaimed films, Serpico being one of them, The Wiz even, is about New York City. I think anything that's considered important in New York, he'll want to tell that story. He came from Broadway. He came from theater. His trick, his specialty, you talk about his techniques, is he was known for taking plays and things that are considered stage-bound. This is a story that essentially happens in one room.
This feels stage-bound, that it could be a Broadway play.
But it makes it feel, through editing and camera movement and performance and all of that, much, much larger in scope. He has that talent. And so many of his acclaimed films were based on Tennessee Williams plays, Arthur Miller, Eugene O'Neill. They never feel speechy. Network is a movie full of monologues, and yet it has so much energy. Lumet is known for getting the most out of his visuals and the most out of his actors. He just always had great people working for him. Everyone from old Hollywood, Brando, Katharine Hepburn, Henry Fonda, to, believe it or not, Vin Diesel and Ethan Hawke and River Phoenix. You know, like, he worked with young and old throughout the generations from the 1950s until the early 2000s. Everybody always wanted to make a Lumet film because they knew they would do their best work with him. And that often proved true.
What was the Vin Diesel movie? I really want to see that now.
Yeah.
Find Me Guilty. I've never seen it. He played a lawyer and gained weight, or at least put on a fat suit, and really tried to act. It is not in any way an action film. And so, what a curiosity, right?
Now I got to see it.
Yeah, no kidding.
It's got to be a good conversation piece, because it stands out like a sore thumb from anything else that he would have been making at that time. But again, who's going to turn this guy down because he is known for just pulling it out of you. Even if you're not a great actor, people will talk about this performance. You talk about Sean Ray calling this Al Pacino's favorite performance. I think Al Pacino calls this Al Pacino's favorite performance.
It's a pretty good performance.
You know, who wants to split hairs? He's made several good films, but it certainly is the thing that stood out to me was that he just, this was, yeah, the first time any major actor had played gay. And then that, yes, to be able to go to these harrowing depths and to walk the line between comedy and suspense the way that this movie does is quite a trick of both the directing and the acting. And props to Pacino.
Yeah, you talk about the humor. There's times where I'm like, this is a Dustin Hoffman film, right? And I guess he was considered at one point. Pacino kept turning this film down. He didn't want to do it.
He had things to lose by this point. It's worth pointing out that Al Pacino came up on the New York stage, and Godfather certainly launched him into the stratosphere. But at this point, he's also made Godfather 2. He was nominated for Scarecrow with Gene Hackman. He was a big celebrity that had his pick. He could do a lot of different things. And so do you take the risk? Do you want to be the first male actor to play gay on screen? It had consequences that he definitely thought long and hard about. And there were times, he claims now that he was never not going to make the movie, but he had his doubts. And Dustin Hoffman was waiting in the wings should he not show up on set.
Yeah, but like you mentioned, Lumet had a long stage career, and Pacino, he hadn't made that many movies at this point, which is surprising to me when I look him up, because I always think he's been in a ton of stuff, but he had a great stage reputation at this time as well. And as you guys mentioned, this often feels like a stage play with its one setting and everything. So he seems particularly positioned to take the role.
Now, for lots of reasons, it felt right for him. But again, I think, he was a big, you say he only made a couple movies. The Godfather and The Godfather 2, some of the biggest movies ever made. And what you do as an encore. I mean, Leo had that after Titanic. What do I do? And
The Beach.
Yes, right. And you can stumble. You can make a wrong choice and not know where to go. And I think he was just in that precarious place of everyone thinks I'm great. I don't want to prove them wrong. I don't want to let them down. I don't know how to do an encore to Godfather and Godfather 2. And so, yes, this movie did do it. He probably could and should have won the Oscar, but this movie had the misfortune of coming out the same year as One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and nobody was going to take it away from Nicholson or anyone else in that production.
I got to ask, Stuart, because, look, this was critically acclaimed. It got a lot of Oscar nominations. This movie comes out in 2024. With these culture wars? No way. And I got to think in the seven, like, it had to be risky to touch this material. Like, you've mentioned, yes, Al Pacino's going to play a gay man. That's not even perhaps the most shocking twist that's going to come in this film.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I do think if you keep in mind that in 1972, when this happened, homosexuality was still considered a mental disorder. The way that people perceive Stonewall riots, where, you know, kind of feels like it echoes what happens in this story. It was the first time that gay people had stood up against police brutality and defending their bar. That was 1969. It was something that people were interested in and they were beginning to talk about. It was topical. And again, Sidney Lumet jumps on that. If something is in the national conversation, Sidney Lumet wants to make a movie about it. Historically speaking, almost all of his films are quote-unquote important in that way, which is not to say he didn't make stinkers, but he always shot for big, important social issue dramas. Also, interesting little twist there. In looking at the real story, Wojtowicz was the man's actual name. He was, and like this movie portrays, he was a Vietnam soldier who fell in love with another soldier while he was over there. And then that soldier died in like a firefight. He came back, messed up, married a woman. He, yes, had the lover that we're going to find out wanted to have a sex change and to pay for it. It was done on a whim. You might say that their suicide attempt spurned him to do the bank heist. But actually, the thing that made him actually go through it, he went to see The Godfather. It was Al Pacino that actually inspired him. After he walked out of that movie, he and some friends from the gay bars went to a bank with guns, dropped the guns, they went off, they grabbed the guns and ran out of there, and then found another bank
So it was more comical than the movie.
It was even more absurd and inspired, always connected to Al Pacino. He even, in handing over the note, says, I'm going to make you an offer you can't refuse. So the Godfather made him do it.
It makes me wonder if he was proud to see himself played by Pacino.
Well, I can speak to that. He was in jail by the time this movie came out, and the warden wasn't sure that they wanted to show it to him, but they ultimately relented, and he more or less liked it, although he didn't like certain aspects that I'm sure as we get through the movie, we'll talk about. Basically, he took offense in the way some things were characterized about him and the John Cazale character. But this was a very big hit. It was hard to ignore. Again, cost $3 million. Made $50 million, which, you know, by 70 standards, is a huge blockbuster. Now, Cuckoo's Nest made $100 million, but it was a very notable film and another feather in Pacino's cap. And, yes, did end up winning the Best Original Screenplay. That was the only Oscar that it did win, which is ironic because...
Based on a Life article, Best Original Screenplay.
Not just that it is an original, but Lumet and Pacino talk extensively about how much was ad-libbed. Much of the dialogue that we're here, Attica, Attica, the things that people quote from this movie, not in the script that won the Oscar. But what is in the script, what is in this movie, Arnie, give them the plot.
In 1972, three men decide to rob a bank. They go right at closing time when there are no customers left in the bank. They take the bank employees hostage. One of the robbers gets spooked and leaves the scene, leaving two robbers, Sonny Wortzik, played by Al Pacino, and his friend Sal, played by John Cazale. Before the two men can escape with the loot, the bank is surrounded by cops. The robbers are trapped inside with a hostage situation on their hands. Sonny goes out several times to talk with Police Sergeant Eugene Moretti, played by Charles Durning, and Sonny wins over the mob of spectators standing just outside the police barricade. After letting a hostage go, Sonny comes up with a plan for escape. He demands the police bring him a helicopter to take him to the airport, where a plane should be waiting to take him and Sal out of the country. The police agree. Before leaving, Sonny insists on talking to his wife, Leon Shermer, who is played by Chris Sarandon. It's revealed that Leon is transgendered, and Sonny was robbing the bank to get money for Leon's gender reassignment surgery. Sonny says goodbye to Leon, and he, Sal, and the hostages get in a car brought to take them to the airport. A car was used as a helicopter couldn't land near the bank. But the car is a trap. Driven by a police officer, as soon as they reach the airport, the driver pulls out a hidden gun and shoots Sal in the head, killing him. Sonny is taken prisoner, and we find out in text that he was sentenced to 20 years in prison, as credits roll.
Didn't serve it, but we'll talk about it. He was out in five. But as we get started, I think they make a point of setting the stage. I think Lumet, I talk about him being a New York director. This is very much characterizing an entire culture, a city. It's a social commentary. What happens in that bank will end up being magnified by the entire city. And I think it's important that we start with a montage that just shows New York in the dog days of this said afternoon. It's an unexceptional day in which the heat is getting to people. And we have the only music that is in this movie. You will notice there is no score. And many times there is no artificial lighting. Lumet really was trying for, he said the word wasn't realism. No one would accept a realistic take on the story. It was too outrageous. But he was going for naturalism. And so this is the only kind of movie moment we have with this Elton John montage of New York City.
I noticed the lack of a score. It's amazing how when there's a score in a film, it won't draw my attention if it's done right. It just heightens the mood. But when it's missing, man, do you notice it. In a good way here, the Foley work and all the sound effects and everything they do in this film works so well without a score. But yeah, we're bopping along to New York City and Elton John's Amarine here at the beginning. It wasn't setting me up for the movie we're going to get.
No.
And Elton John was still closeted at this point, right? They didn't pick Elton John because he was bisexual and this was a gay story, right?
I mean, come on. I don't think Elton John was ever not suspected to be LGBTQ. But yes, he was married to a woman. And at the same time, he was wearing the outfits that he did. I think that was, yes, maybe not unlike Sonny. But in this montage, we see the only dog that we're going to see. I ask you, what do you make of the title? Now, the title of the article they based this on, they considered keeping it for the movie, was The Boys in the Bank, which is a play on the successful Broadway play about gay life that was out at the time called The Boys in the Band. So I don't know how many people would know about The Boys in the Band. It wasn't a very big hit movie. And Boys in the Bank, that sounds too cutesy, right? I don't think that would fit for the movie we're going to watch.
I don't think Sal would like that name.
Yeah, particularly. Dog Day Afternoon makes me think not only is it going to be hot, but every dog has its day, right? That we're going to see someone lowly, someone that's seen as a mongrel outside of a scavenger, and they're going to be celebrated. This is the story of a literal underdog.
Yeah, I actually took the title pretty literally. I use the phrase Dog Day of Summer pretty commonly in my own life, so I was thinking it was going to be a hot summer day, and I thought this would take place in the span of just an afternoon. I thought maybe it would be even in real time. I thought it would just be a few hours. I didn't expect it to also be Dog Day Night.
Well, I mean, it's a 12-hour. Forgive the movie for taking the liberties of going beyond the afternoon span, but it's more or less a day in the life of New York City.
Yeah, it's about heat and hot. This is a sweaty film. You say how much you could just do this on stage. I don't know if you could replicate all the sweat on stage that you'll see in this film, but I don't know. I associate that just like when there's that heat, you get crazy, you get desperate. It makes you do weird things, and that's often associated with like heat waves and things. So yeah, someone just being pushed to the brink.
And we won't even know what we see Pacino sitting in the car before the montage is over. You may not realize that the story has begun, but eventually they do cut back and we see the American flag coming down off the pole. The bank is closing up. It's the end of the day.
And the song is actually playing on the radio, so it's tied into the movie. The robbers are listening to the song as we were.
Again, there is no score. Lumette does not want you to have a movie experience in which horns are pumping you up and getting you adrenalized. Naturalism, again, how you would expect to experience it. Suddenly, yes, this dorky guy with the high forehead is walking in a suit and a briefcase and pulling out a machine gun.
Yeah, there's three robbers. Now, I know from the poster that there's two guys, you know, that's pretty much all I knew going in. But here, we've got Sal, we've got Sonny, and we've got Stevie. So if it's not confusing enough, we've got three S names there.
Stevie ain't gonna last.
Yeah, and that was my first surprise when I first watched this movie. Al Pacino, crime film, gritty, violent, lots of F words. I did not expect it. It's not quite slapstick, but it is funny. Like, this could be a comedy. The way that Stevie is just going to chicken out and be like, I can't do this. And they got to apologize. Can you open the door? Like, let him leave. Like, there's a real sense of humor in this film.
Yeah, I think that you would have the expectation, having just, you know, watched French Connection not so long ago, you're used to thinking about cop work. You know, maybe it has drudgery with some humor in it, but for the most part, kind of, yeah, serious stuff. This movie is pioneering the idea of, you know, something that I think becomes much trendier in the decades that follow. The foolish crooks, the capers that go bad, Coen brother, Fargo kind of criminals. You can't believe they're so stupid. It's pretty obvious, starting with Stevie, that everything is going to go wrong for these bank robbers.
And especially since you've got John Cazale there, you've got Michael and Fredo from The Godfather together again here.
Yeah, it was Pacino pushing that. You know, I don't know that when they were planning this movie that Lumet had seen Godfather Part 2 yet, didn't really know who this actor was. And neither one of them looks like the actual, if you were casting based on the real people, you wouldn't have cast John Cazale. But what Lumet likes about him, it's what I like about him. He's just so sad. There's something about his eyes. And they used it to such great effect as Fredo, too. The unloved brother that was going to get whacked by the end of Godfather 2. You just know that this guy is not going to walk out with a bunch of money and live a happy life.
Yeah, the way he looks. And then when he delivers that line, he wants to go to the country of Wyoming. Like, heartbreaking. Like, I feel bad. This is not a man that should be doing a robbery. I just don't know if he has the smarts to do it.
Clearly, he is in over his head. And yeah, it's just painful to watch Pacino try to manage it. wants Cazal to be taken care of. Like, this is the guy, he's using his muscle to come in. He announces this will only take half an hour. And we just know instantly the wheels are coming off. He couldn't even get the shotgun out of the flower box.
I love when he's like jumping and he has to get a chair to spray paint over the camera. He can't even reach it.
And why bother spray painting over the camera after they've filmed you this whole time? It's not like they were wearing a mask.
Yeah. In so many ways, everything is going wrong. The worst of which is, I mean, if there had been money, that'd been one thing. But the guy downtown lied to them. And all they're getting out of here is $1,100, which is less than half of what Pacino needs.
And that was a lot more money back then, but still $1,100. Certainly not worth the trouble they're going through for it. Especially if you're splitting it in half. Yeah, what Sonny needs is $2,500 for a sex change operation. They were hoping for, I guess, $7,500 if there were three of them and $2,500 apiece, but no, $1,100.
What's interesting, though, is Sonny isn't a complete idiot, and that's why this isn't a broad slapstick. He does seem to know something, like, when he's going through the tellers, he knows which bills are decoy ones and which ones not to take. So he's done some kind of homework, or when I first watched this, I wondered if he worked in a bank himself, and that's why he knew all this.
He does say he worked in a bank, so he was a teller.
Oh, okay, I missed that line then.
Yes, and the real character as well. Even more funny, after he gets out of jail, he goes back to this very same bank and says, hey, I was that guy. You want to hire me as security? Like, as if this were a bragging thing that he had once tried to rob them unsuccessfully.
That happens with a lot of hackers. They get good jobs after they serve their time in security.
Well, maybe if he had gotten a clean getaway, you'd say, yes, I'd want to get the guy that can stop a bank robber.
I have one question, and I had to like look this up, but he's going to burn a register, and I don't understand. I guess it has something to do with traveler's checks, which I have never dealt with in my life.
Yeah, I don't ask me to do finance. I can't even manage my own money, much less what's happening here. The point is obviously that he is trying to cover how much money is being taken so that they, you know, if they're marked bills or I don't know what, but it doesn't really seem to matter because all of it looks like it's going up literally in smoke. The smoke is billowing out of the trash can, drawing attention from people across the street that are coming and knocking. And it isn't long before the cops themselves are parked at the barbershop across the street and know that they're not going to let these guys get away.
A lot of cops come very quickly. I wish cops responded this fast in real life.
This is how you know it's the 70s.
I mean, they have this place surrounded before Sonny and Sal even know what's going on. They think they're about to leave the building. They think this is done. They've got the money. They've got the traveler's checks. And they can leave, and that's when the phone rings, and the bank manager tells Sonny, it's for you, and we begin that introduction of Sergeant Eugene Moretti.
Yeah, so apparently the real story was that almost instantly when they walked in, a teller identified the trouble and rang the bell, the silent alarm, so...
It's the flower box, right? Like, anyone walks into a bank with a flower box, there's a gun inside.
I tend to agree. Just hit the button. And the worst that can happen is it's a false alarm. But probably somebody's going to pull a gun out. And I do feel like there was plenty of time for the police to respond if you understand that. The movie does not draw attention to how the gig is up. There's 100 things identified as to what is going wrong. But the thing that gets, yeah, the cops actually to be there and ready doesn't seem to matter. And the women themselves, that's another bit of comedy that, you know, it's clear that Pacino can't manage them. There's too many of them. They all need to use the bathroom. Some are hiding under the desk, taking smoke breaks in the bathroom. And yeah, he ends up throwing up his hands and handing them a bucket.
I do love Al Pacino's performance here. He is trying to manage this. Like he's, you know, okay, we just got to make a list of what to do and just knock him down. Like he really is trying to tackle this. You can see the gears turning in his head. It's a really fun performance.
Yeah, he's kind of henpecked. Like, we'll find out when we meet the other women in his life that he is just trying to make them happy. Like, he wants to, you know, make his mom happy, and she's, you know, got her own issues and all that. So, yes, in some ways, you see a lot about who this guy is just in these early interactions. And I guess we're also learning about John Cazale's character as well, that Sal is unhinged, that while Sonny might bark loudly, he has no bite when the cops are on the phone. He says, I'll be throwing bodies out the front door if you don't give me what I want. Sal means it. Sal's like, hey, you know what? I'm ready to do that. And we believe he's capable of it too.
I don't have many complaints about this film, but one I have is I don't feel that they sell Sal enough. I'm not getting what you get here, that Sal is unhinged. I wish that there was more exploration. I feel like this movie is sunny, 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 and Sal is forgotten a lot of the time.
I feel like Sal is the one there to provide the tension, because I don't feel like Sonny's actually going to ever hurt anyone. But when Sal says, I don't know if unhinged is the right word, but he is ready to kill people. So I feel like that is always the danger. Like, he might just pull that trigger out of nervousness and shoot someone.
It's really in the performance. We have no evidence of it. You are correct. At no point does he have any violence towards any of these captives. It's the way that he handles them and the sincerity by which he tells Pacino in that moment, if you mean it, I mean it. I'm ready to do it. We have a pact. What gets said is, if we can't get away with the money, we kill ourselves. And I do feel like this is another thing that Sonny has to manage. We see him continuously having things piled on his plate. And the comedy, and I would use that word, is watching him try to remain calm as the load gets heavier and heavier.
I agree. I just wish that there was more. There's two robbers here, and I feel like Sonny gets all the focus, and I wish I felt more threat from Sal. I know I'm told Sal was in Vietnam, and I know Sonny says Sal's a killer.
But he wasn't, and clearly not, because later, when they find out he's never been on an airplane, well, I don't know how you get to Vietnam by the bus.
Maybe he's in the Navy.
This guy is not, yeah, he is not the military guy. I mean, again, the true story was this was just a guy that Sonny knew from bars. But the only one with a Vietnam background, soldier military background, is Al Pacino. And he's got to convince Charles Durning that he means business. This is one of the early roles for Charles Durning. I don't know. Speaking of Coen brothers, I always think of, what, Raising Arizona, Tootsie, comedies of the 80s. But he's quite good here as the first negotiator that these bank robbers will have to deal with.
Yeah, he's the primary face of the police, even though there will be a couple others who come in. This is the one from the beginning, and he'll come back again later on, even after he gets replaced. And like Sal, I wish there was more to him. He is a very flat stock cop character. There's no exploration of the cops in this film. There's just an exploration of Sonny. And so here we have a very functional character doing what we've seen cops do a million times of try to get the hostages out, try to convince the hostage taker, let one go.
I don't know. I think he's going to have some good back and forth with Sonny. Again, just a lot of yelling at each other. And this is all Al Pacino's film. I'm just going to state that. And so if these actors could elevate his performance, give him something good to bounce off of, they're doing good in their part. And I feel like he does that. He plays a good foil for Pacino, someone to yell at and make outrageous comments to.
I agree that Charles Durning himself, you might be tempted to want to give him more characterization. Maybe he has a turn where he has sympathy. This movie stops short of turning Sonny into a hero. I think that we will have empathy for him. I think that the crowd and the media will have him aligned with the audience and further against the police, I guess, in retrospect. We end up choosing the criminal over the cop. But this movie, it would be a mistake if Charles Durning helped Sonny get away, or in some ways showed a turn, an admission that the cops and that the society that they represent did the wrongs to Sonny that they obviously did.
And so this is the movie that brings out the Attica chant, huh? I've heard that in so many movies. I've seen it referenced so often, and I never knew where Attica came from. But that's what Sonny is referencing here, is a case where police killed 42 people, innocent or guilty.
Yeah, they killed security guards.
Yeah, to be fair, it's a real event. To be known, a really important context is this is around the time, 1972, where the sentiment towards police and authority has really shifted in the national conscious. And keep in mind, Watergate is going to bust a couple years later, and American cynicism about the people that are in power will only further erode. Now it's almost a given. I mean, I feel we are so jaded, it's so easy to assume people don't trust authority figures. But here, it means a lot that the cops end up, looking as inept, ineffectual as they do.
Yeah, you see that when they release the first hostage, Howard the security guard, who's having an asthma attack. And I'm always worried, oh no, he's going to die and they're going to think Sonny killed him and storm in. But no, they're going to release him. And what do the cops do? Well, it's a black man. He must be guilty. We're going to swarm him and arrest him, cuff him up.
Yeah. No, it's a really telling moment that a man in medical need, and I do love Pacino's response to that. I can't believe this guy. He's irritated. It's just another problem on his plate that this guy seems to be having some kind of asthmatic attack that could wipe him out here. But Durning is asked for a release of a hostage. He thinks he's communicating that. But yes, what do the cops assume? They see a black man coming out. They assume he's the bank robber. And keep in mind, Attica was a prison riot in which the 42 people you talked about that died were mostly black and shot in the back by guards that didn't have to do that. And I think that's what stood out to people, is that police, through fear, through intimidation, use their weapons to hurt unarmed people, people fleeing, people judged by the color of their skin.
And as an asthmatic, can I just say, what was he doing without his inhaler? You don't do that.
I don't know. Did they have those in 75?
I was taking them in 75.
Okay.
I'm sure they did. And you got to realize that this bank probably wasn't much of a target, right? It was probably an easy job. He probably didn't have to even stand up for much of it. The most he had to do was let the lady with the baby carriage out at the end of the day.
Arnie, you bring up this Attica chant, and this was another surprise to me, because I'm okay, we're in for a crime film, a bank heist. Oh, it's funny. That's fun. Yeah, now I'm seeing the social commentary that, this is about the media glamorizing criminals and them upstaging the police. It keeps evolving. And that's one of the interesting things about this film. It never stays in one genre too long. It's always got more to add.
Yeah, something else that's really worth pointing out that would have been relatively new is that news cameras weren't portable. You really couldn't go out there and capture until recently. This would have been around the first times that a bunch of media would have a helicopter, would have people in a van or a school bus, as it turns out, and be able to go down there and actually film in progress the bank robber, that he can actually have that moment. I love this scene where Pacino is talking on the phone. Somebody, some newscaster has called him. They have one of those portable black and white TVs. He looks out the window, turns back, and that's his face on the TV. That wouldn't have been possible even a few years earlier. So a lot of what's happening here, I probably think there were bank robberies all the time, but there weren't these kind of media hostage situations because all of this was new. This technology was new. This idea of becoming a celebrity, going viral. Now I think we take that for granted, that somebody unknown could be the thing that everyone talks about in the next couple hours. But this is sort of at its infancy, where we realize that this lowly guy that never had any attention and none of the help that he needed is suddenly being turned into some kind of folk hero.
And this is where I feel the script is being improvised at this point. Whenever Al Pacino's just addressing people, yelling, "You got it! You got it right! You got it!" I'm okay, he's just making that up on the fly.
It feels very naturalistic. I never really thought about whether or not it was ad-libbing, but I'm taken in so much by Pacino's performance here and the way he's delivering these lines. I am with the mob sentiment of being on his side.
Yeah, you get it right here early. And why are they? Some of it is just the novelty of they feel participatory in it. And yes, later he'll be throwing money at them, marked bills though they may be. He's sharing in the wealth. But I also just think that, yes, there is a sentiment that is growing in popularity in 1972 that the cops aren't always the protectors that they would have us believe. And certainly this movie lives in that kind of hippie sentimentality about authority. Also worth pointing out, Charles Durning thought he was going to get a girl free, right? He comes out with the head of the tellers, Sylvia, this tough-talking Irish woman, And she refuses to go. He grabs her arm and says, okay, you're out of here, thinking she'll be so grateful. And she'd rather go back with Sonny inside. Now, she says she's doing it for her girls. I'm sure there's some truth to that. But her allegiance to being in the situation sort of helps further along the idea that people are excited about what Sonny is doing, that people want to help him do what he's doing.
Yeah, the tellers, they start off, of course, very afraid. And this head teller kind of makes a nuisance of herself, saying she has to use the bathroom. And then he finds another teller in the bathroom. And then everybody wants to go to the bathroom. But it's not very long before they seem to be enjoying the attention themselves as much as Sonny is. And they're having fun in the bank. They don't want to leave.
I like, yeah, one of them, Carol Kane, in fact. I'm like, that actress looks familiar. And it's Carol Kane. And, like, I think it's her husband is calling up and, like, when is dinner? It's funny stuff. But, yeah, you can see the Stockholm Syndrome set in with these tellers.
It's not just Stockholm Syndrome, though. It's not just alliance to Sonny. I do think Arnie is on to something. They're waving at the camera. This may be the first time that they've ever been paid attention to. Again, they're underpaid. He's going to highlight that to the press and point out the fact that, yeah, his hostages make barely any more than he does. And so, yeah, solidarity is setting in because of the media. If there weren't those crowds, if it weren't on camera, I don't think the situation would go the way that it does. And maybe it would go Attica. Maybe they would just gun in and that would be the end of it. But the media and our ability to be there and watch is what has changed everything.
And it is just interesting moment that feels very modern when Sonny is watching himself on TV, but then Sonny starts cursing and they cut him off and start showing cartoons or something silly.
Yeah, you can't say the F word, even if, you know, we want to be there, but this, there are censors and commercials.
Come on, they're not on a 5-second delay.
Yeah, they wouldn't have known that yet. Again, this is media in its infancy, too. I mean, that's what I find charming now. Now everyone has a phone, everyone is a cameraman, everyone can capture injustice, it can go viral. We've seen that story so often, but here, this may be one of the first examples. It is quaint, really, in some ways, to see how people that had never gotten attention suddenly are stars. Even the pizza delivery guy that will later be brought in to feed them is eating it up, just can't believe that he's on camera too. And that's just one of many Sonny demands. You know, it's interesting. Early on, again, the pact was we get away with the money or we kill ourselves. Sonny doesn't want to kill himself. And so he's calculating. And so now he's trying to strategize, well, what are my demands? How can I negotiate here? I do have power. I think that that's what that Attica moment showed. He could go out there and tell the cops to holster their guns. And they do. So what can he make them do? Somewhere along the lines, they have a cockamamie scheme to get a jet out of the country. Algeria. I hear Algeria named for reasons.
Why Algeria? There'll be a whole debate about it.
Getting away. It's something that he did not, again, if you consider the real story of I just watched The Godfather and thought I can act like a mobster and get cash. Yeah, it really wasn't well thought out. And now he's trying to turn it into some kind of escape from America.
Yeah, originally they thought they were just going to drive away. When Stevie left, he had to take the subway. He was not allowed to take the getaway car.
Yeah, leave the keys. I do love that. Yeah, he's like, no, how will I get home? Yeah, it's so, again, it's so charming how ill-equipped. And I do want to highlight that, again, it's a dangerous precedent to say that the, you know, bank robbers are better than the cops. I think this movie could easily overplay its hand, and it never quite goes there. Sonny is mentally ill. Sonny should not get away with this. And yet we will see, for my money, this is the story about learning how a system failed someone. Starting with the fact that, yes, he's got a military rifle and clearly he got some damage for Vietnam, right? This would have been one of the first movies to acknowledge we didn't do right by our servicemen that served in that unjust war. And I think that remains a subtext watching this. Of, oh, Sonny just needed someone to talk to. Sonny wouldn't have reached this situation if we had treated our vets better.
Yeah, it's kind of underdeveloped in this movie. Vietnam is mentioned, but, you know, I think looking at this as this wouldn't have happened if we treat our vets better was something that is brought in with more historical knowledge.
Subtext. I mean, that is what subtext is. We're not going to make it the story. I appreciate that. To me, that's exactly how you want to play it, because everyone in 1975 knows what Vietnam is. It was on their TV every night.
Yeah, I was going to say, like that traveler's check register, I'm like, I don't really understand what that's about. I know what Vietnam is. I get that. But I do think, like, for modern audiences, I know many of our listeners are younger than us. How much of this stuff will they get? They haven't grown up with that context. I'm able to get enough of it. And I appreciate, like you said, Stuart, that it remains subtext, because I think there's a lot going on in this film. And if you try to champion any one thing and make this film, this is what it's about, I don't think it's as powerful. That to make it kind of this snapshot of New York at the time and what people were going through politically, like, I think it works as this broad statement on society.
Yeah, I mean, I think what Lamette had said and what he saw the story as being, for him, the story he said he was telling was, we think that they're freaks, but we find out that we have a lot in common with them. And I do think the second act of this movie, as they are strategizing about how to get away, we are starting to have a slow reveal about the life of Sonny and maybe what motivated him to even doing this. I mean, again, for the first 20 minutes of this movie, you're like, this guy did not think this through. Is he an idiot? He's not an idiot. He's just damaged. And it seems like a lot of that damage comes from the women in his life, right? We see the mom at home who's like, why didn't he tell me he needed money? And later will be, you know, storming down there, not listening to him, hugging him, and telling him just to give up. And I just feel like that's probably what she's told him his entire life. It feels like this character, you know, you hate to be that reductive, but I do feel like this mother character, inserting it in this way, you realize that his parents were not in Sonny's corner. And one of the many reasons why he has such difficulty being normal.
Well, I hadn't seen this film before, but the one thing that I knew coming in, I can't remember if I got it from Lumet's book or just, you know, movie knowledge in general, but I knew that Sonny was gay. And so I'm questioning everything I know when they introduce us to Sonny's wife and Sonny's kids. They say, go get Sonny's wife, and they show the wife, and I'm like, wait a second, was I thinking of a different movie? What is going on here?
And see, I didn't have that knowledge, so I'm like, oh, here's his wife. And again, it's kind of broadly comedic. She's this blabbermouth that won't shut up, and, you know, it works comedy-wise, but then they're going to bring his wife later on. I'm like, that's a different person altogether. Like, what is going on here?
Yeah, I like the way that that works, because we do meet the wife. Yes, she's at McDonald's with the kids, gets wind of it, just like the mother. She seems very shrewish. Her response is, I'm not going down there, and blabbing to the cops about domestic violence, right? How she used to beat him with a jackhammer is the story I hear. And so, again, another person that has failed Sonny, right? He's trying to pay child support and welfare and take care of this family. Was this what it was all about? Did she drive him to do this? I think we are to have those feelings so that we are really going to have the rug pulled out on us at the hour mark when we really meet the other wife. But before we get there, I mean, we do have that classic scene of one of the demands is we want pizza and beer. Well, no beer. You can have soda. And yeah, this hilarious moment where Maria's boyfriend is tackling Pacino and the pizza guy is strolling up and the chaos. Again, when Lumet is at his best, you feel like everything is just about to come off. Again, even though this is one location and you could, you know, just make this a play, it is so cinematic because all of these elements, the editing, the camera work, the dollies, all of that, just so kinetic.
I mean, around this time, the AC's gone out, Pacino's going to fix it, notice someone's coming through the back door, fires a shot, and you get this shot of the cops, there's like, one, I don't know, it's funny, he's like hanging on a rope and like trying to climb up it quickly or something. It's just chaos going on, but it still feels dangerous too. Now that a shot's been fired, are all the cops just going to open fire on them now? So like, there's humor and there's also tension and danger going on at the same time.
And the crowds are getting bigger. One thing I love to hear about is that they paid 300 people to show up and they cast them. They're like, you're going to be kids that ditch school and you're going to do this and all of that. But they end up having over 1,000 people that just people were drawn to this movie set. And the actors were actually coaching the rest of the people unpaid to participate. So when they're calling out, you know, sometimes the cops are trying to talk on bullhorn and the crowd is mimicking them or whatever. That is just the people of New York City, literally, getting into this movie.
Not written in the script.
Yeah. And again, it speaks to the idea that there's something about cameras and media attention, particularly at that time when it was so rare and so many people lived a life where they were not noticed, that there was no social media for them to be a focus in. It's quite something to have this moment in your neighborhood suddenly explode. And that's what it feels like to me. Chaos is suddenly exploding all around, and this little contained thing is spreading throughout the city, infecting everyone. And I think it's around this time that they have decided that the deal that is struck is, I will give you a girl every time you give me something I want.
A chopper to get to the airport, and then a jet to get to Algeria.
They end up settling on a limo, but yes, transportation to JFK, and then wherever we go, which again, airline terrorism was definitely a thing by 1972. So they are copying what they've heard on the TV news and now becoming those terrorists. And maybe the only thing that Sonny has to keep him here in New York City is Leon. Yes, at the 64-minute mark, the big twist that, Arnie, you knew was coming, and Jacob, you did not know was coming.
No idea this is where this movie was going.
Second wife and not a woman.
I mean, to the point where the first time I watched this with my wife, we paused it. We're like, wait, what is going on? We saw his wife. Like, it was a real shock.
And the fact that the cops kind of introduced, though, that we got his wife where he told us, Bellevue. Well, that's the mental hospital. And so you know that there's something else going on. And honestly, I thought maybe Leon was just in the mental hospital for being gay. I mean, this is the 70s. It was classified as a mental illness. I was wondering if that's why he was there.
I mean, I think that's probably still accurate. You can assume that if they were being treated, the treatment was in part to recognize their identity. Notice Leon doesn't say, I want to be a woman. He was told by his shrink, you're a woman trapped in a man's body. And I think that kind of labeling, that kind of gross, I'm going to diagnose your condition instead of listening to you, is what's gotten psychiatry into a lot of trouble. And I wouldn't be confident that Leon is trans, just that Leon has been abused and not listened to.
Yeah. What Leon says, though, is he attempted suicide, and that's when they put him in the hospital, is he took a bunch of pills.
Yeah, I'm not sure what Leon's state of mind is regarding his gender identity. We see a wedding photo, and he does dress as a woman for that wedding.
Yes. This was toned down. This is one of the choices that they made. Lamette said, we know when we bring this in, we're going to get some titters. That people are just going to be shocked, and we know how people act when they're uncomfortable, particularly about sexuality. And so we want to kind of treat, we want the humor to be more like, here comes Leon, and yes, looking like still in a bathrobe, bedraggled, fainting, doing sort of this comic housewife bit. And then we want to be able to settle down and give this relationship some serious weight to it. And I think that meant letting us have our laughter out here early on so that we could then start to explore it. It was considered that they would show images from the wedding because there is footage of that. And they were actually married. It was a gay priest, and in defiance, he was defrocked, but he did marry them. There were drag queen bridesmaids and all of that. They had filmed it. They were going to do it. And the fear was the audience would never get over to the sympathetic side, that the largely heterosexual audience would just think that that's too much and not be able to go with the movie's dramatics as the relationship gets explained. Probably a wise thing to do in 1975. I think if they ever remade this thing, you could probably even start at the wedding. But now, yes, is not what it was then. And queer visibility being what it is in 1975, it's probably just enough to see Chris Sarandon in a veil and, yeah, bridal gown.
And Chris Sarandon, man, what a performance he gives here. I didn't realize he was acting this early. I looked it up. It's his second role ever in film. But I think he plays it really well. I think he plays it femme, but he's supposed to be the wife and he's supposed to be possibly transgendered. But I also think he plays it with a sensitivity that I wouldn't necessarily have expected. My go-to for like 70s and early 80s gay is Billy Crystal on Soap, which is, again, one of the more sensitive portrayals, but still very broad and comedic at that point. And I think that Sarandon plays it straight, as in dramatic, pretty well.
Yeah, I never feel like it's a caricature. Like, there is that initial shock, even watching this in 2018 when I did, because I didn't know it was coming. I'm like, oh, and realizing this is 1975 when this movie was made, like, I'm like, wow, this is really going somewhere. But it, yeah, it doesn't, like, he's got the funny hair and everything, and at first, like, he's all drugged up. But yeah, you get your laughs there, but I think he ends up giving a very dramatic performance when he gets his scene with Pacino.
Oscar nominated as well. He was up for supporting actor. He lost to George Burns. But yes, I agree with you. All that you're sharing here is I think it's a tricky role, and in some ways it's set up as a punchline, and they get the laughter out early, and then very quickly we see that there's trauma here. And again, Sonny is no saint. Sonny is abusive in this relationship just as he is in his heterosexual marriage. Do not fall for the trap that Sonny is entirely a victim. Sonny is, I think, a victim of a society that doesn't understand, marginalize, has driven him to the brink, but he is acting irrationally and has hurt many people, and I do think Leon is one of them.
And it's interesting to me how they portray the relationship between Sonny and Leon, because Sonny is doing this to get money for Leon's sex change operation, but Leon is not so attached to Sonny. Sonny's been abusive. Sonny disappears. Their relationship is not idyllic by any stretch of the imagination.
No, I don't think they're together. Again, my sense is that, yes, they want a divorce. If this was a marriage of any kind, whatever that happened, that it's only in Sonny's head. That Sonny is doing this not just for sex change surgery, but try to salvage a relationship that I'm going to win you back. Because I don't want to live with my wife. And that's my other option here. So I do feel, again, there's a tragedy to the subtext. At this time, this was a man that did not feel like he could live the homosexual life. And so he married a woman he didn't love that turned sour and violent and then tried to have a relationship with someone who does not want him. And every effort that he takes, aggressive, violent, to control that relationship only seems to be, yeah, getting him in deeper and deeper trouble. Notice, too, what's happening in the bank. When those women hear what happened, you see a change in their mood, too. They're less friendly. They're more genuinely shocked. More pity I see in their eyes towards Sonny at that point. They don't see him at all, I think, as an aggressor towards them anymore.
But this is where Sal, it comes out on the news that there's two homosexuals doing this bank robbery. And again, maybe this is the underexplored character of Sal. Like, he has a real problem with that. And I do wonder, like, how does he feel about Sonny? He has to know that he is gay and the fact that he really doesn't like having that label put upon him. There's some interesting things there that just go underexplored.
Yeah, and I think better to do so because it isn't Sal's movie. And we want him just to remain this sort of threat, this cocked gun that could go off at any moment, that he could just snap for a woman smoking a cigarette and choke her dead just because, you know, he's got these weird ethics about the body is the temple and you don't get cancer by smoking cigarettes. So many contradictions, so much wrong there. It would be difficult to unpack what's wrong with Sal. You just know that you would not want him to have a gun in his hand. That is the danger, I think, for these women, is that they do not see Sonny as the threat, but Sal is a different story. And Sal, I think this is where the real life Sonny took issue. The power gets cut, the FBI take over, and it looks like, at least according to our real life Sonny, that they strike a deal. We'll let you go and we'll take care of Sal. You won't get hurt if you sit back and be quiet. And the real life character made very clear that he never sold out his friend, that he would not want anyone to have the impression that he co-signed on Sal getting shot in the head.
Okay, I never took it that way, that he was buying into it. And I got to say, this FBI agent, I don't know what you guys thought, but every time I saw him, I wrote down W, because that just looked like George W. Bush as the head FBI agent there. It was very distracting. But I felt like, yeah, they were saying, hey, we could pin this all on Sal. Like, it was a way, you want to create that rift between them. It's a way to weaken them. But I felt like Sonny was never going to betray Sal.
No, I didn't get that either. In fact, the look on Pacino's face when he says this tells me his allegiance is completely to Sal, and that he's shocked that the FBI agent would even think of such a thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think that is the way it came off. I think that that's, again, the paranoia of the person watching their life being changed for entertainment. He did end up suing the movie, and I think he did win. He got 1% of the profits, which he ended up squandering. But yes, his case was that he wanted to make sure that people understood. And I think it's pretty clear that Sonny tries to remain loyal to everyone. Maybe that's his flaw, is that he's still trying to do right by this shrewish wife he doesn't love and Leon, who doesn't love him.
Yeah, that's what I find interesting about him, is that he's doing these awful things, of course, but he's a people pleaser. He wants to make everyone happy. He wants to make all those women happy. Everyone. He's trying to please everyone too much. Like, he needs, unlike that psychiatrist that diagnosed Leon, he needs a good psychiatrist to really help him with these issues.
But that's what makes Sonny such a likable character. You know, it's so easy to make a bank robber a villain and, you know, a hostage taker a villain. But to make Pacino, to have us completely on his side, the fact that he is so naive and trying so hard to get everyone to like him while being in this media spotlight and everything. And it's interesting to me because once it comes out that he's homosexual, the crowd turns on him. You know, there's a small section of the crowd that's very pro-LGBT.
Well, the gay community comes down there once it comes out. It
becomes part of the circus, is that there's new chants and new bickering and fighting.
Yeah, but it seems like the vast majority of the audience that have been cheering for him the whole time suddenly turn against him because he is now the other. He is apart from them.
You see it in the room, and you feel it from the crowd outside the room as well, is that something has changed now that we know the true story. And, I don't know, Leon kind of, it's self-serving, right? When they're having the phone conversation, some of what Leon doing is just trying to clear his name. He tells them they're not listening, and then we cut and see very clearly the FBI is leaning in. This is a character that is self-preserving, and you have to feel a little bit for Sonny, and that you know that his love is genuine and not being reciprocated.
Well, that's what's so heartbreaking to me about that scene is, like, Sonny does love Leon, and I just never get that feeling coming back from Leon towards Sonny.
No, you don't. It's surprising that they got married the way Leon acts here.
I mean, I think even the phone conversation with the other wife, too. I mean, you know, she starts to blame herself for getting fat, and did he marry a man because I wasn't good enough? You know, I think that's always the anxiety when a partner goes off with someone goes gay, and like, it's my failing in some way. I see in the humanity in these scenes. Again, these are things that could easily be played for kind of melodramatic, tawdry drama or farce. You know, we could be snickering. And I think the line that gets walked, the thing that I appreciate about the performances and Lamette's approach, is that I have real empathy for everyone here. It is heartbreaking. There is no more laughter by this point. It's gotten quiet, and we're even seeing Sonny knowing there's no plane anywhere, that he's dictating his will and giving away his life insurance policy to both of his wives.
All three of the women in his life. He calls out his mom, too.
This movie really has slowed down in its second hour. You know, the first hour, there's a lot going on. The taking of the bank and the police outside. Here, we get some more introspective moments, and it's nice to get time to spend with these characters. The story sucked me in the first hour, and now during these scenes like the long phone call with Leon or the long scene dictating the will, is really nice to slow down and see these characters in a more introspective way.
And again, Pacino's at the top of his game. Like, yeah, I can watch him dictate a will any day as long as it's good as that scene. Like, I'm leaning in. The way he's just, again, I feel like he loves both of those wives, maybe in different ways, maybe it's twisted, but like there is real emotion in him.
And Lebette knew, in order to get this performance too, one of the things I appreciate, they did 3 weeks of rehearsals, just as you would a play or something like that, and major things changed. They even had to reshoot some things because the way Pacino started the performance, he's like, no, this won't work. But he knew that these scenes, you can feel them. You say they're slower, they're longer. They literally are. He let the camera go. They are done in one take. He knew that Pacino wouldn't be good shooting around, getting different angles. You know, the way you have to do movie acting oftentimes is hitting marks. Here, he lets him have his monologue. You're going to do the whole scene, one take. We're going to film it all. And they cut around it. We don't watch it as one take. But I think it's what enables Pacino to be so real and genuine in the moment. We're seeing Pacino, the stage actor, and not the movie actor. But eventually, it's time to go to the airport. And I want to point out, among this cast of recognizable faces, this is Lance Hendrickson's first movie. He is the guy that will get picked to drive them to the airport when the friendly, Afro-smiling first driver is just not working for Pacino.
I agree that a lot of the humor has gone away at this point, but again, this is kind of funny. Is Sonny just paranoid at this point, or it feels like he's trying to be like, I'm really smart, and I know this black limo driver is really a cop, so I'll take the FBI agent because I know what I'm dealing with then. And I do feel like George W. Bush, the head of the FBI in this film, is kind of just smirking at him, laughing like, you're foolish.
Again, I think I'm fooled because, again, I would want to get in the car with this guy more than these stone-faced feds. You know, they don't seem like a good crew, but yeah, it's an act. And I think that Sonny is just, at this point, you know, we've had so much heartbreak for him. I think he knows that this is doom. I think he knows there is no real plane ride to Algeria at the end of this. And he's just trying to go along with it, almost to protect the women in the car and Sal.
And they're really setting you up for something because Lance Hendrickson keeps telling Sal, point that gun up. I don't want that gun to go off if I go over a bump or something. And like the fact that he just keeps telling him to point, take the gun off of him. I'm like, they're setting something up here.
And what I thought they might be setting up is that Sal was going to shoot him. I was waiting for Sal to snap. I was not expecting them to have a gun in the car after the way Pacino searched that car so thoroughly. I was expecting that Sal was going to do something here.
And they have set up Quentin Tarantino for at least one movie, maybe two. But Pulp Fiction, they definitely take that idea, that concept, and go full force into the bump that shoots the face off the guy. I also think Dog Day Afternoon, Reservoir Dogs, it has been speculated that this movie was highly influential on both of Tarantino's first two films, or at least referenced. And why wouldn't they? I mean, again, this is gripping. You know, real tragedies are, you know that the outcome will not be good, and yet you're still hoping, right? There's still tension in the idea as they're riding up on the tarmac.
I want Sal to get to Wyoming.
You do. You know that they can't, and you can't help wanting them to get away anyway, because life has been hard enough for them, right? They just needed a break. And they're going to be rewarded with a, you know, bullet in the head and 20-year sentence.
What's funny is, because this movie came out in the 70s, I just expected both of them to die. I expected Sonny and Sal to both die, because that's just how movies were.
Yeah, I remembered it that Pacino died. I did not remember that he was, as promised, sat back and was quiet and was delivered. And it's interesting that the women didn't want to leave him, even in that moment, too. You see that they're being pulled from the limo, and their allegiance, however temporary, is that they feel for this guy. We all do. Their reaction is our reaction. We hate the fact that, yeah, this man that needed so much help is yet again being condemned by the system.
And did they really need to kill Sal? I mean, was that a necessary kill, or was that a brief Attica moment where Hendrickson shoots Sal in the head?
He had a gun on him. I mean, the cops are justified if you got a gun on them.
It's a calculation. And I hear what you're saying is they probably could have done this without it. But the understanding we are to have, particularly about the FBI, is that they will make cold calculations. And so, yeah, it's a tragedy to a certain extent. I mean, again, it's wrong to rob a bank. And yet, did this guy deserve this? No. Now that we've seen why he was motivated to do it, all the ways that his life had been so tragic, again, we see the injustice. A Lumet picture yet again about social injustice. He was wronged and didn't have a prayer. And I guess maybe we should feel good about the fact that the real life guy got out a few years after this movie came out, but never did have much success. He did get some money for this movie, but ultimately died on welfare in poverty. Leon died of AIDS in the 80s. It did not sound like a happy story.
I mean, his female wife stayed on welfare. Like, I thought that was funny. That's her call out.
Yeah, right. Yeah, no one benefited. For all of this talk of money and robbing a bank, everyone remained destitute. It didn't really address what was wrong in the first place.
So, Jacob, Stewart, do you recommend Dog Day Afternoon? Jacob.
Yeah, this was one when I first watched it a few years ago. It was a real pleasant surprise, and I'm glad I got to revisit it because it is a film. Hopefully you watched it before listening to this review because it's a real wild ride. Like, I went in thinking, oh, gritty bank heist movie. No, this is funny. I'm laughing. This comedy of errors. And then halfway through, like, it takes this real dramatic turn into sexual and gender identity. And it's been talking about society with, you know, the attitudes on cops and the press and how that's changing everything. I think Lumet really was able to take what was going on at the time and condense it into a 2-hour film. And that's extremely impressive, especially when it's as good as this one is. Like, I go through a real variety of emotions. I think, especially for the time this came out, it treats some controversial topics in a sensitive way. It doesn't make it a sideshow circus as much as the press is throughout this movie. I do feel like this is more or less a sympathetic view towards the LGBTQ plus community. I don't identify in any of those ways. I'm an ally, but I don't think there's anything horribly offensive here in that. Is always kind of a surprise, especially in an older film, to see it treated that way. But yeah, I think, again, the cinematography, Dog Day Afternoon, hot, heat, I feel sweaty watching this. It feels like it could be confined on a stage, and yet it feels like it's also exposing all of New York City and just being a documentary of what was going on at the times. It captures so much in a pretty efficient way. Again, this is just a 2-hour film, and I feel like there's so much more material here. This is a strong recommend for Dog Day Afternoon.
Stuart.
Yeah, I think it's still a riveting viewing experience nearly 50 years later. And part of that is because Lumet is a gifted director and he's working at the height of his powers. If you think about it being directed by somebody else, you'd easily imagine this day feeling smaller. Speechy exchanges, single location, starts to get claustrophobic like filmed theater. But Lumet always finds a way to push through with the camera, with the editing. We break through those bank walls. We always feel that what's happening in that small space is being explored and exploding, having a social impact throughout the world, throughout New York City. And this movie just captures the spirit of New York as it takes a look at this small, unnoticed life. I also think that Lumet is pushing his cast to do their finest work, that Cazale and Pacino particularly are doing this amazing high-wire act where they could easily fall into hokey melodrama. Chris Sarandon, too, could easily have been a mincing stereotype and a belittling farce. And yet we always find a way to laugh and appreciate the absurdity and never feel like their humanity has been taken. And that is not an easy thing to pull. I really think that that is a strength of this movie, is its sensitivity towards its subject, even as it finds outrageous laughter and the craziness of what is obviously a ridiculous situation. And I think the movie is even more interesting now when you view it with the 50-year measuring stick that we now can, because obviously culture has changed, right? LGBTQ visibility, trans visibility has changed. The whole idea of viral sensations, you know, the unlikely person suddenly becoming a celebrity overnight. This is the beginnings of all of our culture now, and how quaint and fun to see how novel it was on one street corner in Brooklyn, what now feels like every corner in America, every corner of the world. The picture might have stumbled if it pushed too hard in making Sonny look like a crusader. I think the parting thing I want to focus on is that you could have easily sold this as he was justified in doing what he had to for his love and really making that melodramatic and making it this story about anything for love. And I think that Lumet always directs us back towards the flaws, to the short-sightedness, to the mental illness, the absurdity of this. And by doing so, we don't have a fairy tale. We don't have a melodrama. What we have is a portrait of society that has failed Sonny. That when I watch this movie, I see a war vet who needed mental health. I see a homosexual who had to marry a woman to feel accepted, and their love with a trans woman. You know, I'd like to believe that now we would give that storyline more dignity than it was ever going to receive, mediated in 1974. Many have tried to wrap their arms around this kind of storytelling. It is not easy to do. Bonfire of the Vanities comes to mind. American Beauty comes to mind. And in many cases, I think it's easy to stumble. It's easy to push the farce too much. It's easy to sell or oversell the melodrama. And here, I think this is really one of the finest examples of social satire I've ever seen. And a crack and suspense movie to boot. So for me, it's an extremely high recommend.
And for me, you know, Dog Day Afternoon isn't what I expected it to be. I knew the general plot going in, and I thought it would be more suspense. I thought it would be a taut, tense thriller. Instead, what it is in my mind is more of a dramedy. But it does have the pressure cooker situation. Because of Lumet directing, I was reminded of 12 Angry Men more than I expected. You've got all those people in the bank just having to work with each other and form alliances and things. But what I also didn't realize coming in is that this is a star vehicle for Pacino and Pacino only. When the credits start, it's like in huge font, Al Pacino, Dog Day Afternoon, and then there's some other names. There's others in the film, they get a moment here or there, but I think the only character that gets truly explored is Sonny. And in a lot of movies, I would call that a big mistake. I mean, we get to see Sonny has two wives and his mother, but does Sal have any attachments? Do the cops have any personality beyond their job? Everyone except Pacino is just a type, and that feels like a missed opportunity. But why it works here is because everyone's yielding the stage to Pacino in what's almost a one-man show. And man, 70s Pacino had the goods. He delivers a nuanced performance of a gay man doing extreme things for love and does so without being extreme or flamboyant or funny in a time when that would have been the norm on film. I mean, Pacino does great in the big moments without being big like you think of Pacino now going big, you know?
Yeah, he's robbed banks or been in bank robbery movies since. And look at that ass!
Exactly. But he does the big moments well, riling up the mob outside, shouting Attica, but he really delivers in the more quiet moments, convincing Sal they shouldn't kill themselves, on the phone with Leon, dictating his will. I mean, we've reviewed a lot of Pacino films, and other than The Godfather, I think this may be his best performance that I've ever seen. He owns this screen from beginning to end, and I can't ignore the talent of Lumet behind the camera, making everything feel natural, as you said, Stuart. I think that's a great term for it. Doing the entire movie with no score, it forces the performers to carry all the emotion. And again, Pacino's up to the task. I think it's good to bring in a stage actor here for what's essentially stage work without a score, without a lot of special lighting. It's a really strong recommend for Dog Day Afternoon. It deserves the classic status it holds. I wish it hadn't taken me this long to get around to see it, and I'm sure there's going to be even more for me to appreciate when I watch it again in the future. It's a very rich, dynamic film. Solid recommend.
Great. We don't always get that, but yeah, three emphatic, you should really see this film. It's not always easy to get motivated to watch a 50-year-old movie, but I think this is one everyone should take in.
So thank you for picking it, Sean. Greatly appreciate it. You finally gave me the excuse I needed to, I'd say get off the couch, but actually get on the couch and watch this movie. And we've got two movies for you patrons next month, both patron picks.
Yeah, a little sci-fi twofer. I think of a small movie that I'm told is a real classic, The Man from Earth, I don't think any of us have ever even heard of it, much less seen it.
Not the man who fell to Earth.
Correct.
The man from Earth. Okay.
The man from Earth is not a man I have met. But one of you has told us that we need to, and that it's one of the better sci-fi movies of the last 20 years. We will put that to the test next week. And then in 3 weeks, a sci-fi series that was supposed to be the next Star Trek, but didn't even make it past season one, did have a spin-off movie. Firefly by Joss Whedon is this beloved little property that had this beloved little movie called Serenity, and we'll find out whether it holds water 20 years later.
Careful, you don't want to upset the Browncoats.
Oh, God, no. I will talk about my experiences with Browncoats.
Uh-oh, I'm sure you have experiences from all those cons you've been to.
What are Browncoats?
Fans of Serenity, or Firefly.
Okay, they actually have names.
Yeah.
And I have been working my way through the Firefly series over the past couple of weeks, so I will have watched that entire series when we review that movie in 3 weeks. So thank you again to Sean Ray. Thank you to all you patrons who have supported our show. Keep us going. We love you so much. Thank you. And Jacob Stewart, thank you for joining me. And until next time, we said a mouthful, sweetheart.
Of days gone by when we would lean, laughing, fit to burst upon each other.
Oh, fuck. We did it. We did it.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
Look, you're being very cooperative with me. I got no complaints against you whatsoever.
And a special thank you to Sean Ray for his support of our show and for picking Dog Day Afternoon for our hosts to review.
I made it happen so far, right? I can make it happen.
The opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the views of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Were you serious about what you said?
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
I'm a Catholic, and I don't want to hurt anybody, understand?
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
There's the FBI.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2024, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
I'll see you in my dreams, huh?
Like a puppet child.